Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Modern. I'm joined today by Splash, Cat, and Test, and we're going to be discussing the results of the previous GP. So first off, we're going to kind of cover the decks we chose. Splash, Cat, are you willing to go first?
Yeah, so for Grand Prix Zanzibar, I played Big Red, which is an archetype that's been around for a while. I've gone through a lot of iteration. And until recently was 80 cards using Unrivaled Fire Weaver. But after Fire Weaver was nerfed, it's been rebuilt as a 60-card deck. And I tested it in League before the Grand Prix, so should I go into more detail about the deck's game plan?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that it can curve out very well with Ragavan Most Wanted or Lieutenant Daisy Saxon on turn one, both of which get you more advantage as the game goes on. Ragavan helps you play your powerful four drops ahead of schedule, and Daisy grows as you're curving out. And you also have Leaf Down Sizzle Mage, who's a creature with an adventure that's a piratic ritual.
So, at least it had it.
Well, yeah. it has since been nerfed for mostly unrelated reasons, but not entirely unrelated reasons. which lets you play your three drops on turn two and four drops on turn three. And a number of those cards create snowballing advantage, because Emissary of Antiquity lets you put on pressure and also get mana advantage, because you get to cast an instant or sorcery spell with mana value through your last pure hand for free whenever it connects. And two new Ancient Shapers, a card advantage engine for a drop slot. And to a lesser extent, Oros is also another source of card advantage. So it's... the idea is that you come out fast and try and get one of these threats down early and build up too much pressure too fast for your opponent to deal with.
Cool.
Yeah, it's not quite all in aggro like burn, but it's like it's trying to take advantage of how fast it can start
threatening
things while still having sustain in the tank. So it's like it's not throwing everything and then burning out, it's like throwing everything and you've got to stop it before it just keeps doing even more things.
My opinion is that the main distinction between Big Red and regular burn is you are going to be getting a lot of damage for each card, which does make you a bit more resilient for going to turn five and past. You're of course giving up your viability for turn four.
Yeah. The deck has not had turn four kills since the Kinkin nerf, I don't think.
Turn four is for if you go all in on burn.
My general experience playing against the deck is that it feels very close to like a kind of classic mid-range deck where its ability to play as the beatdown or as the control is a relevant part of its strength in a bunch of matchups. So the fact that Big Red versus some decks can just say, whatever, I'm going to grind you out, and versus other decks just says, whatever, I'm going to burn you out, is a huge part of its strength. And the fact that it has these aggressive hands means it can run clunkier cards that you couldn't get in, like, traditional burn. So it can be on Aros, it can be on Prescience, etc.
I mostly respect the deck for being able to run Daisy Saxon.
Yeah, that deck is very cool as a deck that has gotten people to say that Daisy Saxon is one of, if not the best creatures in the format, which I think is entirely wild.
She's a very straightforward mid-range kind of card. You just turn her sideways, and if she's ever in danger of being lost, you just use her activated ability to get one last bit of value.
The
big problem that keeps her from Classic Burn is Classic Burn's curve is way too low for her, and she hasn't got haste.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So yeah, that is why I respect the more mid-rangey approach to aggro.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to leverage Cadence when your deck is 50% one drops.
Honestly, the success of Daisy Saxon is a very good reminder to me that there is no world in which we should ever unnerf Almgrove Champion.
This is correct.
For anyone who has, yeah, I was going to say, if anyone hasn't been playing MSCM for 4+ years, Almgrove Champion got a hit in the first May Madness. It's currently 1W for a 1/1 first strike Cadence. First strike used to be double strike.
Classic 4 damage on turn 2. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I got hit for 6 on turn 2 once because my opponent had some like cost reduce spell. I think it would have won the bleed spells or something.
right,
yeah.
So Thrasis is also something that counts for that.
Or just in general,
like, first damage step.
I just remember one game where Jame was playing this Jeskai Almgrove Champion tempo deck, which is why Almgrove Champion has a champion, actually. And went turn 1 Almgrove, I played a turn 2, or turn 1 Shock Fetch and passed, and JN Imperial Siege my Shock Fetch and swung for 4, and I immediately was like, oh, this game's not going to go well. Test, how about you? How did you pick your deck for this GP?
So, how did I pick it? I was going back and forth on going against the meta or going against people's inclinations to brew or just brewing myself. And prior to the GP, I was bouncing around Aristocrats, Legends, just straight up Jund. Gerald was very attractive in that regard. And we can see that we'll get to Scribble later on, who built a so-called dry snapcaster Jund. But in my case, eventually there was enough attention being devoted to a mix of Aristocrats, which didn't really materialize, Legends, which did materialize, and Goblin Chariot, which also materialized. So, when you have a bunch of low-to-the-ground creatures and a bunch of combo decks running around, which rely on specific in-hand combos, the anti-meta answer to this is Villainy. Villainy manhandles core combos out of hand because it runs 12 pieces of hand interaction, which is ludicrously high. And of course, Villainy itself, if you ever untap with it, just kills boards dead. The lack of creatures in Villainy also means that you get to run Exeunt, and you get to run Singularity's Grasp, guilty-free. And Sai had specifically called out Singularity's Grasp. That is an XBG card. It does minus X across the board and destroys all enchantments and artifacts of X or less mana value. Sai had specifically called out that card as probably the most relevant piece of sideboard for the meta in the coming month. This also applied to Kaelin, one bogeyman who... I don't believe Kaelin made it into top 8.
I don't remember any Kaelin decks making it into top 8.
And if we just double check...
Yeah, good call to double check.
And yes, there were around 4 Kaelin decks running this GP. Kaelin was very much hyped up ahead of it, and that did affect my decision to include Rot in my sideboard. But in the end, Kaelin did not make it into top 8. Kaelin was soundly beaten by most of the other decks running around. So, now that I've gone the preamble out of the way of how I chose Villainy, Villainy is a classic deck. The deck is, like, what, 4 years old now?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Villainy is a classic, but for anyone who needs a reintroduction to it, it's a 3-mana pure black enchantment. Whenever you cast a black non-creature, you drain 2 of it of any target, so that's a creature or player, which is already on its own, just in terms of pure numbers, having inevitability, great. But the secondary ability that draws you card the first time that a creature dies each turn, well, it loses you a bit of life, but who cares? You already get life from the card.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that can turn mashups for creature decks just completely hopeless for them. But for the deck building, I actually did not really account for the second ability on Villainy that much. We mostly run it because it kills our opponent while we're doing other things.
It's an incidental win con that can double as removal.
Yes. So, being a rather old deck, there were various older versions of Villainy. There are some staples of the deck which have been pretty much unchanged over the years. Exeunt, instant speed symmetrical sacrifice, which is not so symmetrical if you don't run your own creatures. There is a Dark Bargain, which is a 1-mana cantrip in black, which can cantrip again for 1 mana. And previously, there had been some people running Find Happiness in Misery, which was a 2-mana leitmotif in black, which milled and drew cards. Now, while this did mean that you could get 2 casts for the leitmotif for Villainy, one of the early changes that I decided on going into this deck was that I would replace the Find Happiness in Misery with some Miserable Discoveries. Miserable Discovery does not get you the second cast, but that is sort of tending towards the philosophy of running slightly worse cards to make your best cards better. Miserable Discovery, in terms of total mana for cards, comes out to 2 net, though slightly spaced out because of the treasure token coming in tapped, which puts it on par with Dark Bargain. So the draw base was made more consistent that way. Another thing was that we dropped Zanigan, we did not bother with Empimo, and we did not bother with Urbeck. Something that I've been doing for the past 2 GPs is, for relatively low-to-the-ground decks, I've been trying to optimize their mana curves to win on a certain turn, or to have certain things done by a certain turn. And when we did that analysis for a 5-turn horizon and a 6-turn horizon in Villainy, we found that we did not have any room for 5-mana cards, period. Whatsoever. So we settled instead on some different victory conditions. We have the 4 win conditions in Villainy, but in addition we have the win conditions of 2 copies of Bal's Descent, which I'll get to in a moment, and 2 copies of Monument of Queens. I was not the first person to put Monument of Queens in a Villainy deck. I believe that was Time Spiral who did that. And you can get away with 2 copies of it if you have 22 black sources, going by how many black sources you need to cast Villainy on turn 3. Monument of Queens, in general, I think many more decks could stand to run it, because if your primary plan fails, you do have some form of inevitability. You don't just sit there drawing cards until your opponent kills you. Now, on Bal's Descent has a front side, which is a symmetrical discard, a symmetrical sacrifice, and mill, which is nice. Being able to hit an opponent for up to 3 cards for 4 mana is a fairly good benchmark. And the mill helps the second ability. The second ability is what we really run Bal's Descent for. It's one of those, I believe it's Altabach.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those Altabach gods that if you have enough of a basic land type, you can flip it into some ludicrously powerful creature. And these have been nerfed in the past because they are, among other things, indestructible, large-bodied, and have very relevant effects. Bal's Descent turns into a Yawgmoth's Will. That's not an exaggeration. It is more or less the text of Yawgmoth's Will.
On a 6/6 indestructible creature.
Yes. And it does not end with the turn. If you flip a Bal's Descent, and your opponent does not immediately get rid of it, you just win. So, as far as win conditions go, it compares very nicely to things like Zanigan or Urbeck. Because by the time we play those on turn 5, we could have also played our 5th Swamp and flipped Bal's Descent to win. So that's the general idea of what the deck does to win. Now, how does the deck get there? It's what you call tap control, or rather tap out control, in which you will mostly be using your interactions such as hand attacks on your turn, so-called tapping out in order to prevent your opponent from killing you or from comboing off. The main pieces of interaction in this deck are hand attacks and spot removal. So for spot removal, we dip into green in order to play Pithwelt, and green also gets us Rot and Singularity's Grasp on the sideboard. And for hand attacks, we have the classic Valdez, who caused quite a stir when he was first introduced. Prying Inquiry, which is still a supremely messed up card. I can't believe it's costed the way it is. Pay Up, because we can threaten a turn 2 villainy if our opponent doesn't play ball. And, well, we can kind of count Bell's Ascent as hand interaction, but that's mostly to close out the game. Some people don't really like watching villainy because it sort of shakes out to watching someone just stop their opponent from doing anything for about 4 turns before they just start slowly killing them. I like to think that this deck is at least a tolerable speed once its finishers are out, but that is pretty much the style of villainy. Kill everything dead, wait until you have your finishers, play them, win.
And you don't have to wait very long because your finishers are 3 and 4 mana.
Yes, and the fact that most of our things that trigger villainy are cantrips of some kind helps. We also have Whisperwoods Exploration, which has no restriction on bringing back other Whisperwoods Explorations. So if our opponent isn't doing anything, we can just dump mana into killing them. Whisperwoods Exploration also gets us back our villainy, because having a backup plan is nice.
So,
and in general, I think that the deck is not a major refinement, but I think I've managed to fix up some old versions of the list to be generally more reliable, generally faster, generally less vulnerable to interaction.
The fact that you're on Whisperwoods Exploration does make me a little bit surprised that you're not on Find Happiness, because one of the advantages of Find Happiness traditionally wasn't the fact that it, you know, was 2 casts. Like, that's an incidental upside, but it's not really why you play it. The ability to bin things was really good for both the no rest variants of villainy and the variants that had regrowths in general.
Right, and I did consider it for that reason, but Whisperwoods, really most of the reason that we run it is so that we can recur a known target.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you recur, for example, a Dark Bargain with it, that's going to be 4 mana for 2 cards spaced out, which is still pretty efficient. We don't need to fill our graveyard to do anything fancy. Same deal with Bow's Descent. Bow's Descent can tempt you into doing self-mill stuff, but you don't need it.
You can just chain cantrips.
Yeah.
So, in a case where we are sort of a control deck that has to outpace other control decks, that has to outpace combo in some cases, if you can't stop it out of hand, I think that the speed is a little bit more important, speed being a direct translation of mana, than your ability to dig. With 2 Monuments of Queens, 2 Bow's Ascent, and 4 Villainies, plus 4 Valdez if you count him as a finisher, we have plenty of opportunities to draw into our stuff without digging for it necessarily. And in some cases where we do end up waiting for draws, we have the benefit of the matchup where we can just wait our opponent out if things go really badly and we run out of proper draw.
Yeah, Villainy is a deck that historically top decks pretty well because each of them either draw cards or answer one or more of your opponent's next threats. You only end up in trouble if you top deck like multiple swamps in a row.
Mm-hmm.
So, in general, Whisperwoods Exploration can be considered kind of a kicker. Everything's a kicker. It's essentially a kicker for our other spells.
Okay, sure.
Rather than a consistency tool, per se.
Kicker, draw this card. Okay.
Because if you want to dig, you're not going to get anywhere with 2 mana. If you want to dig, you have a wealth of options at 1 mana, like Seek Prophecy.
Sure.
Of course, you're not going to play Seek Prophecy and Villainy, but that's an idea of what our competition is.
Um, I guess to start going over the deck that I ended up picking for this GP. Going to this GP, I did actually a lot of brewing. I threw around a bunch of decks in deck building, and there were a couple that tempted me pretty hard. But one that I kind of kept looking back at is just in general trying to find some shell to leverage Salome, because I was like, you know, of the cards in ACT, this is, I think, the most powerful one that I am the most excited to play. It's possible there were more powerful cards in ACT, but if there were, they certainly weren't ones that, like, fit my playstyle as much. And I'd discussed with Purple and a couple of other people in deck building some different ways to build Salome. I tried the Cane Dancer builds, but all of them looked kind of abysmal to me because the deck restrictions you have to put on yourself to play Cane Dancer in a deck are higher than you'd expect. And especially if you're also trying to be a Salome deck and a Heart Attack deck, you don't have the slots to make the deck work the way you want it to. You end up with a really funky looking curve, and there's a bunch of other similar issues. So
it's getting very easy to drop Cane Dancer.
Yeah. I think also, especially as we nerfing Ready for Anything after this GP has once again given a hit to Cane Dancer stock, which I certainly don't think there's any issue with Cane Dancer becoming a worse card.
Yeah, before Ready for Anything, I found sometimes it was difficult to make Cane Dancer decks because my best options for card draw didn't play super nice with Cane Dancer.
Yeah.
You don't get that much out of Dancering Reveal Eternities. You want to get half of the draw out of Dancering Planet Far, Far Away. You get all of Ready for Anything.
Yeah. I think the fact that Ready for Anything is draw two off Cane Dancer and everything else that you can fight at two mana is draw one is probably a sign for one of the reasons Ready for Anything was a messed up card. But in general, when building this Grixis Heart Attack list, I took a lot of the lessons I learned with playing Valerie Heart Attack in Leagues the month before, where basically the logic being with Heart Attack, you can just make your deck as efficient as possible with just like on the order of five pieces of top end. I think my current list has closer to six or seven. And just as long as your interaction is cheap and as long as your setup and most of your card advantage is cheap, your go over the top tools then kind of get to sucker punch people.
Heart Attack is fundamentally messed up.
Yeah. Because
all you have to do is run a couple of searchable win cons and then everything else is interaction. Everything else.
I think in general, one of the things that makes Heart Attack really good is a lot of the earlier. There's like a couple of different schools of thought with Heart Attack, right? And I generally have been playing Black Axe Heart Attack decks, like a lot of Grixis, a lot of Bug. And Cyber has tended towards playing Bug and Bant primarily. I think in general, Cyber's preferences are very ready. Recall Frigana Aeons adjacent, I think is the best way to put it. Whereas I don't actually think you need to ever play a ramp spell in a Heart Attack deck, because if you literally just hit your land drops and have a Heart of Zadina somewhere in your deck, that's plenty of ramp to be able to kill an opponent.
That was kind of my experience playing blue-white GU Offering Pools,
mm-hmm.
which was also on Heart, which was very good for activating pools. You just kind of got there.
Ramp in general seems like a bit of a scam in this case, because if you're ramping, you're trying to trade time for mana and a card, but it puts you down on interaction, and it also puts you down on a card, which means fewer options for interaction in itself. You are the ultimate long tail in the question of who is the beatdown. I don't think there's any deck which is slower than Heart Attack while still having a reasonable game plan.
Mm-hmm.
Salome is like a turn 7 play a lot of the time, isn't she?
She was pretty reliably turn 6, I think. But I also, since I only ran 3 copies and I wasn't selecting for her in the early game, I think there was basically never a game where I played her on curve.
So The only competition for that speed would be Old Juyu, wouldn't it?
I mean, I think in general, the reason to play ramp in these sorts of archetypes is A, because you can play ramp spells that double as win cons, and right. B, because you can play ramp spells that don't force you to go shields down. Like, if you play turn 3 RFE, you still hold up an Axion after that. You just get to go the little bit faster you get to go. Does Old mean other control decks that you can go under or other combo decks where you only need to fend off the first wave of bullshit rather than first two waves of bullshit?
Well, in terms of the waves of bullshit, there was another reason that people played RFE a bunch in recent years. And that's because it costs 3 mana and does not cost red and white.
True. Enabling... I don't think I ever saw a Thunder Road spliced heart attack deck, but thinking about that, that sounds awesome. I wish I could see that.
You should probably ask Herzy.
Yeah, message Herzy. Say, hey, can you hook me up? But yeah, in general, this GP, it was very much just, what's the best shell for me to put Salome in? I think it's heart attack. Let's build this list. And one of the other big takeaways in my deck building was trying to index very heavily on our 2-mana cards that are both A, card selection, and also card advantage. So that was really Ready for Anything and Reveal Eternities, since I felt that that really gives control a lot more ability to, like, always end up doing the thing. And in general, with hard tech especially, but control in MSCM in general, my experience is if you can do the thing, which is you survive full turn 4 or 5-ish, and then you play the big stupid card your deck is built around, you will win the game. And there's very little that goes over the top of a well-built control deck.
There is also the fact that your usual in-hand counters don't work on heart the same way that you'd expect them to. Because our best hand attacks don't hit lands like Heart of Shadina. So yeah. Instead, if you're going hand attacks against heart attack, assuming you get past the counters, your only hope is to get rid of either the Shadina targets or to get rid of the searches, as Shadina isn't already in hand.
Definitely hitting searches is good. The current heart attack list I was on this GP actually has very few, you know, has fairly little direct access to heart. It's running, I think, 2 main deck Cosmic Coalescings and 1 main deck heart. And that's running, obviously, heart of the sideboard that you Cosmic Coalescing for. I think in general, Salome is partially messed up because she makes the deck much less reliant on heart attack. Or, sorry, heart of Zedina.
Salome just wins the game eventually.
Yeah, and she generates enough mana on her own that you don't need to worry about it. So I had a game where I just never got access to a heart, and it just didn't matter. I guess we should probably switch from talking about like deck selection to talk about how the GP went. Splashcat, could you go first on that front?
So my showing in the GP was not great. I did well with the deck in League. It did not do so well in the GP.
She mashed against me in the first round.
Part of this is because
not a very good game.
Part of this is because I got matched against Test round 1, and I am playing an aggressive creature deck, and Test is playing a villainy control deck, and villainy eats Big Red alive.
Big Red has such a predictable sequence that you can literally just keep hand attacking their next play, and there's nothing that they can do.
Yeah,
The only thing that I lost in that case was me going after one of Sizzle Mage's targets, because I thought that Splashcat didn't have any, and then she top decked an Emissary, and I got kicked in the teeth.
Yeah.
Which, why didn't I target the freaking Sizzle Mage? That was my fault.
Basically every card in Villainy lines up well into my cards, and Villainy itself, it's like, okay, I have like 1 turn to kill, maybe 2 if I have a really good 2 new line. After that, Villainy is going to draw cards and gain life faster than I can take it down, and there is nothing my deck can possibly do about it because I am in mono red and can't destroy enchantments.
Were you on a bunch of Exhilarating Presciences?
Was I on doing my GP? No, I was not, and this is because the other problem with my deck is I forgot to adjust the sideboard. I threw a random sideboard together to test lead quickly, and then I did not make a better sideboard, even though purple had already made a better sideboard for the dragon's version of big red. I should be on exhilarating prescience's, and that would have given me a better shot, but still a bad one.
Yeah, I think that card is really difficult for villainy decks to address if you manage to top deck it, or basically, because that and Tunu allow you to just generate enough cards or enough mana to potentially go over the top.
I will note that it did not matter in either two games that I played, because I just had shut Splash Cat out of playing anything so effectively.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that Exhilarating Prescience costs 3.
Yeah.
My deck runs Pithwilt.
Mm, right, you're on the Pithwilt builds.
And yeah. Also, your hand attack costs less than 3.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that has been good against villainy traditionally is including deck cards in your deck that are just like, you know, you can top deck them. The main issue with hand attack is it doesn't have bullshit insurance. If your opponent just draws well, you're kind of shit out of luck.
We did see that with the Emissary game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I also just, this deck has no top decks which are good against the villainy if I don't already have stuff in play, right? It's like,
yeah.
I'm going to top deck a Tunu and I'm going to draw one card off of it, and then Test is going to cast 2 spells and kill Tunu.
Yeah.
I top deck an Oros and I draw 3 cards and they are all equally useless.
And you deal 1 damage. Don't forget the 1 damage.
This is true.
Yeah, there were a solid number of lonely Oroses on board.
And yeah. Beyond that round 1, Splash Cat, did it feel like you just had a bad deck for the GP, or you just like ran cold for the first 2 rounds?
What was my round 2 matchup again? I was matched up. Okay, right. So round 2, I was matched up against Garolo on Fireweaver 8 sack.
Oh yeah.
With, with Chaos is Your Redemption as a Fireweaver target.
Which is functionally just grabbing another place. It's
another
grabbing
sacks,
yeah.
And that deck did very silly things to me, mostly involving fetching Kaioro, and then
just playing like solitaire, more or less.
Okay,
yeah.
It's like I curve out for the first 3 turns, then their board explodes, and it's like, okay, it's turn 3, and you just remove my Emissary with an Earthbreaker Behemoth, and now you're tutoring Kaioro, and you're recasting everything from your graveyard, and I can't remove Kaioro because it's 4 toughness on ward 3, so it dodges all my removal spells. And yeah.
Yep, that seems pretty rough.
It's not an unwinnable matchup, but it was 2-1, but I feel like it's like 60-40. That deck just does some very stupid things. And has a number of options it can trigger which are very good against my deck, like Oozing Yaogwai, which basically goes like 3-for-1 because it kills one of my things.
Gains 3 lives.
Body, and the third life is basically like, yeah, that's important because I can't, it makes it harder for me to just burn them out once they make a board.
Yeah.
Right, but like the biggest mark against you in this kind of matchup is that you don't have a stack interaction.
Yeah.
If you can't do something like Catch Fire Weaver, those decks will just maul you.
Yeah, I can't counter the pods and blow them out. The closest thing I have to stack interaction is Cinderhoof Minotaur. And it's not like Cinderhoof Minotaur is bad in the matchup, but getting a bolt out of it is not enough to stop them. It is not Stormer that might actually conceivably stop them from being able to kill. It is just a decent 2 drop. And they are making 5 drops to make more value and don't guide removal.
Clearly, we need to print a red find nothing that bolts your opponent instead of draws a card. Stranglehold isn't high. This is completely fine.
Maybe we could get something that burns on shuffle.
There we go.
Pay no attention to my next set to be submitted, by the way.
Actually, we already have two cards that burn on shuffle.
Completely yeah, but this was better.
Okay.
What's the ETF card that burns on shuffle?
It's Marglin, because front side causes your opponent to lose life whenever they shuffle. Mm. But that's talking about cards that aren't the format yet. Let's stay focused. You got Milkshook. The Swiss seating was not kind to you, it looks like.
No. And then I could have kept going, but I was like, I'm just going to drop, and I'm going to try, and I'm just going to spend my MSCM time playing League instead, because I'm in contention for League Crown, and then we all saw how that turned out.
For anyone who's listening in the future, there was a 7-way tie for first?
Nine-way tie. Two more people got in at the end. I saw a deck list in 5-0 by Ricky, and I was like, oh no, the tie's broken. I don't have the crown anymore. And I checked the leaderboard to confirm, and no, Ricky had not actually been one of the people in tie, because I lost track of them all.
Oh god.
What nine people who all had one 5-0 run, and two more 4-1 runs, and no second 5-0. I lost a 4-0.
Love puzzle, though. Lots of games getting played.
Yep. I lost a 4-0 run in the last game. I totally punted, too. If I had either two new, I had a great chance to play either 2-0 or Cecilius turn 3. I played Cecilius. I could have played 2-0.
Mm.
I forgot that Cecilius minus 2 is... it was like, well, Cecilius minus 2 makes 2 threats. 2-0, I might not get a threat I can play, but... I forgot that Cecilia just dies to burn and 2-0 plus 1 does not. Anyway, so I am on a tangent.
Alright. So, Test, how did your GP go?
My GP went a fair bit better. We already talked about me getting matched with Splashcat in the first round. After that, in the second round, I got another bit of rotten luck. after conferring with Nyx, / Nyxoleum, ahead of the GP where I strongly recommended burn to them, I got matched with them in round 2. And sometimes you play Villainy on turn 3 and it does nothing as you get beaten to death. And I was arguing with people in the past 2 months, what does Villainy do against burn? It all comes down to how many cards they have in hand, and it comes down to Exeunt. Because there are hands where burn just cannot win against Villainy. It literally does not have enough mana in time and enough cards drawn within 4 turns to win. And once you're out of the woods there, there's very little that Burn can do. Granted, these games were close. I put a lot of effort into playing around Beaten Batter, which was spending its last month as the ultimate answer to life gain. Now, my copy of Villainy runs stands in the sideboard, Stand Unassailable. What I would do was, I would put out Villainy first, I would notice that my opponent was holding up mana for Beaten Batter, and I just keep on getting life from Villainy until my opponent caved and Beaten Battered it. At which point, I would Stand Unassailable, and the game would be over. There was also an instance in one of our games where an Exeunt on an empty board saved me from a civilization's cost thanks to a Villainy trigger.
Nice.
Yeah, that's historically been one of the really strong things about Villainy, is how all of your interaction also can just double as shocks or life gain in a pinch.
Again, we run Villainy because it turns every single card you have into something that both keeps you from dying and something that kills the opponent. Never underestimate the power of Villainy's mode without the second.
I always love when a line comes up which is like... 1 in 1,000. I can't believe this is actually the correct choice in this situation.
Right, but anyway, playing against Nyx with the full power of Brazen Sacrilege and Beaten Batter, I think I earned my win. I think I played very smart, getting around Beaten Batter by paying attention to the opponent and baiting that out early. But after that, the later rounds were a bit less close. In round 3, I was up against, this was Hitster on Goblin Chariot. Goblin Chariot is a very exciting card, but it was literally one of the reasons that I chose Villainy this month. So poor Hitster got completely manhandled. There were cases where their board was completely empty, especially after Singularity's Grasp in Game 2, and there really wasn't much that they could do there. So, moving on to Round 4, that was us, Pip. We intentionally drew because we both had top seeding, and I really did not feel like fighting Heart Attack that night.
I don't think that's a particularly great matchup for you either.
Right. Well, it turned out to be a moot point anyway, because in my first game in top 8, I lost to Legends. Now, there are two big factors in this. One of the thing is that in both games that I lost, the thing that killed me was Lisa. Lisa the Daughter is the 1-1 for 1 white, or rather she was, that summoned a 4-1 flyer demon on entry. And a 4-1 flying for 2, I mean, we have stuff like Chili in the format, but that's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
The card also double dips stuff like Emperor's Retainer for his Anthem bonuses.
And Jack.
Yes. So Lisa the Daughter is going to 3 mana after that month. Good riddance. But I can only get so far by blaming stupidly powerful cards. I run those too. I played somewhat poorly at those games. I think that I should have mulliganed for, especially in Game 2 and Game 3, Game 2 was a moot point because I locked out my opponent's hand, but Game 3 I should have definitely mulliganed for Singularity's Grasp or Rot better. It would have potentially won me it because my opponent had completely overextended. Alas, in those opening turns I never drew into them, and if I had mulliganed, that could have been Game 3 and another game in Top 8. But 1-2 to
that one friend, is that the same username they use on Discord?
Neon Blue. That was right, 1-2 to Neon Blue, and that was the end of my run.
Right.
Now, as for the rest of the Top 8, congratulations again, Pip. You're the winner of the whole thing.
I had a pretty clean run through my first 3 rounds before the ID. I played against Ricky, who, you know, Ricky was on Black Red on Earth. I survived the first couple early attacks, and I top decked really well to beat Hand Attack, which that's the issue with playing Hand Attack. And just always had the exact removal spell I needed at the exact moment. Round 2, I played against one of the Caitlyn decks. My opponent apparently punted one of the games. I kept a sketch hand in game 1, but one of the things going to this GP that I had tried to convince myself was, on paper, I should have an okay Caitlyn matchup, and that did actually play out the way I'd hoped it would. Game 2, I won via a early Exeunt on a Caitlyn and then Seal the Tomb of the Caitlyn. I'm normally not a proponent of Seal the Tomb against fair decks, but I figured in that matchup, it really just boiled down to, if they have Caitlyn, they can go over the top of me, and if they don't, they can't. And my opponent agreed and immediately scooped after the Seal the Tomb. And then in round 3, I was against Herzy, who was also on a Caitlyn deck, was on a Caitlyn control deck, and I similarly just went bigger over the top of that, and just never tapped out or gave Herzy an opportunity to resolve something that I couldn't immediately beat. Top 8 run was a little bit stressful. My first thing was against Scribble, who was on a kind of Jund deck that I think on paper could have probably been a rough matchup if Scribble's cards had played a little bit nicer, but they didn't. And I think also Scribble relied a little too heavily on trying to use The Past Is Gone as a way to answer my over-the-top mechanisms, which I don't think is sufficient in that matchup. That was a 2-0. I played against Styles in the semifinals, which was a really close 3-round match, or 3-game match. I think Styles' deck, the kind of standard Jeskai control Cosmic Space Princess deck, which is, you know, using the Spirit Script shell, is like very well positioned to beat up on Heart Attack style things. Has scaling counter magic that is live throughout the entire game, even versus pretty heinous amounts of mana. And also has some like really good card draw that I can't contest as much as I would like. But I think in general, Styles is the beatdown in that matchup. And I think Styles, as a player, generally likes to be the control. And so I think some of the in game three, got mana screwed. So that obviously was very helpful. But I think in some of the games, the pace of play on both of our sides ended up just kind of favoring me. And then was the finals versus Skagra, who was on Mono Red Storm, which is, I think, the big boogeyman of this GP after, like, the first round.
The real boogeyman. Yeah. Not that Kaelin hype.
Yeah, the Kaelin deck, I think, was probably a little bit better than the numbers it put up suggested, because if you look through, Kaelin decks actually kind of cannibalized each other's records, and also I beat up two of them. So I think the deck probably was a little bit better, but
the deck had a better showing in the league than it did in the GP.
Yeah.
Now, Kaelin, of course, can't compete with genuine turn two wins.
Right.
Was what this mono red storm could put forth.
I think after the first round of the GP, Skagra might have posted saying, I think the deck I am on in this GP is a deck the council should have their eyes on. I think this might be a power level.
Yes, I remember this. And then I remember seeing in council chat somebody mentioning that Skagra had said this. And then I went to play a league game. And then I queued against, I forget who it was, Acolyte, I think.
Yeah,
I can't remember. Playing that deck, and I immediately got turn two.
Yeah,
I was like, I see what Skag was talking about here.
I think my favorite thing of that was Herzy. I think this was mostly in council chat, so we're going to leak some DMs here. But someone had claimed that the Mono Red Storm deck like was fast and looked scary, but it was also hella inconsistent. And so Herzy started watching every single match played with it and tracking how many turn two and turn three kills it was getting. And was like, yeah, the deck's super inconsistent. It actually only turn twos people like 20% of the time and turn threes them another 70% of the time. Super inconsistent. Well, when you put it that way.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so, the deck is horrifying. I am not surprised it lost to a control deck because Force Spike is very good against all-in stat combo, but
I kind of
between that and Heart Attack, I don't even feel bad that I lost round one of the top eight, because my next round would have been against Skagra.
Yeah, that's not a good matchup for
you. Have Heart Attack.
You have Heart Attack. You can Exeunt a Shimmering Dragon. Just Exeunt the Shimmering Dragon.
See,
it dies in two shots.
I did try to run the numbers on how likely I am to live a turn three on that. On turn two, I just can't. I can't. Yeah. There is nothing I can do. On turn two, they've already cast so many spells that not even two Exeunts will save my life. I just die.
Scans. I think people said dismiss Skagra's matchup there a little bit out of hand, because like, oh, it's a blue control deck. But I don't know. I was cutting a bunch of my counter magic when I was building this deck. I was on very little counter magic and had so little control. Like, if Skagra jams three Shimmering Dragons to play, I basically can't beat that. And my ability to stop Skagra from getting three Shimmering Dragons to play is very limited. It definitely got better for me post-board. And even pre-board, like, I do have Exeunt as a slight hedge. But I think people definitely overstated how good of a matchup that was for the control deck.
Yeah, this is true. I hadn't looked at your list in detail, but looking over it now, I was like, oh, this is less counter magic than I expected.
Yeah.
The other thing is that Skagra's deck has a backup plan in Treasure Beach.
Yeah. It is not impossible for Skagra to play in a way that means that Cosmic Sinkhole is next to offline, and pre-board, if Cosmic Sinkhole is offline, my ability to do literally anything is incredibly limited.
Mm-hmm.
And then even post-board, like, it still isn't great. The fact that Salome does functionally let me get my wincon into play without tapping out, because Salome, you can immediately hold up mana afterwards because of the plus one. And I think just broadly speaking, Salome is very good at basically saying, you have one turn to kill me, because if I untap with this Planeswalker, I've already generated six cards and a bunch of mana, and you're not going to win from that point.
And or like you win on the turn that you play slow a lot of the time.
I did not. I think I actually never won the turn I played Sloam, except for one game where I top decked her when I had like 10 lands and heart in play, which I think is not the typical circumstance.
Mm. I remember that one game where you spent 27 mana in one turn.
Yeah. I never actually had one of the games where I cycled a Sloam, but I definitely had game states where I realized, you know, if I draw Sloam right now, even though I have a Sloam in play, I think I immediately play the second one and just plus. Which is a very funny circumstance to end up in, but also kind of egregious. But yeah,
I feel like I've done Valier minus five into Valier at some point, but I can't remember the circumstances.
Yeah, I think Valier is a great comparison point because I think Sloam is like the fair deck Valier. And I think there were a lot of games this GP that Sloam was able to win that literally a Valier could not have won, which is probably an issue. I'm glad we're hitting that. Yeah.
What were you going to say, Test?
Well, if you want my opinion, the Sloam hit doesn't actually... Okay, well, the Sloam hit does address the Sloam as a backup plan. The Sloam hit does very little about the Sloam for the win.
Mm-hmm. I think...
does bother me a little bit. From a certain, somewhat dour perspective, this was a post-patch GP... where the two contenders for the finals were both running egregiously broken cards.
I mean,
which?
How often do you have a GP where the winning deck or the two decks in the finals aren't running egregiously broken cards?
So, the trick then is you compare to the rest of top eight.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, there are enough decks running some cards that they can be considered an accepted part of power level. But in the immediate post-GP patch, especially with a relatively low, well, ridiculously low player count, let's be honest, as this, sometimes someone will discover a deck and get their free win for the month. And when it happens that both of these decks are in the finals, no, that's a bit of a harsh way to put it. It feels a bit less like a matter of skill and matchup, and more a matter of seeing which lucky contestant has a deck that is more egregious than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, your cutting of counter magic did make it a bit interesting.
I mean, I also
it
think
was definitely magic... a game. It was not a non-game by any means.
I think the counter magic is also one of the reasons the deck did fairly well. Like, I think counter magic was not well suited for the format. But yeah, I get what you're saying. I get that from a viewer perspective, it can be kind of frustrating or boring to feel like the two decks who are in contention to win the GP are there just because, like, you know, okay, well, they found the broken cards. I don't think it's that hard to imagine a world where things break slightly different for, you know, Styles. Styles doesn't get mana screwed in game three, is able to contest a Sloam, and is in the finals versus Skagra. And I think Styles' match versus Skagra is, like, insanely good because of how much counter magic Styles gets to run.
Well, you play Styles, not me, so it's your call.
But
I mean, I accepted my fate. When I choose to revamp old decks with mostly old cards, that is the chance that I take.
I will also point out that Skagra's deck does not actually run any MSL or ACT cards, period.
Dragonstone kind of came out of nowhere. At least it wasn't on people's radar until Skagra turn two'd somebody with it.
Oh, right. That is right. Skagra had all existing tools.
I feel like we screwed up letting Sloam into the format, though. Sloam should not have been added to the format like that.
I think it's really important to remember that this is nerfed.
Yes.
I think it is exceptionally important to remember that Sloam initially was even more egregious than this current design. But yeah, I think Sloam was us looking to take a chance on a card because 6-mana Planeswalkers are very hard to evaluate because 6 mana is so much mana in an MSEM context. And I think it's fair to be a little bit like, okay, well, how didn't they see that this was broken? But also, no one else was playing Salome this GP. So, I don't know. It's one of those things where MSEM has a lot of different broken things to do, such that whenever someone succeeds with one broken card, it's very easy to say, well, obviously that was broken. Why didn't they do something about it? But the truth is,
I knew Salome was a ridiculously good card. I had ragged on so many people trying to put untaps in their sets, especially untaps with card advantage or digging.
Sure.
In this format, a huge factor in what the meta is what decks do you want to play?
Mm-hmm.
Because while I do play control this GP, it's really not the same kind of control as Heart Attack.
Yeah. I think there's more... I guess the way I would put it is both of them are in the vague category of decks I see as pipsqueak control decks in this format, where there's, broadly speaking, decks I like to play as control, and the decks that, like, Herzy or Cypher likes to play as control, and then decks that Purple likes to play as control. And we have other control players that have their own, like, styles or, like, I mean, I was going to say styles as in playstyle, but styles is a very good example of a player who have their own, like, sections that pie. But I've generally found that there are a lot of decks that other respectable control players play and see success with that just whatever I pick just go to shit. And I've generally found that the more flowcharty a control deck is, the more I can succeed with it. And both Villainy and Heart Attack are incredibly flowcharty control decks. You're trying to hit your engine. Once your engine is online, all of your cards move you to a win state.
My point there, though, is even if people can identify a card as incredibly broken ahead of time, they might just not play it because it only fits in decks that they can't really, that they're really not interested in playing.
Yeah, I've noticed this.
At the time, a few years ago, when it was stuff like, I really ought to come up with a snappy name for those decks that ran 12 copies of one mana enchantments with EDB value.
I don't think that there was that many.
Flatfield too.
I don't think there were that many decks running all 12, but basically, like, all the good decks for a GP or so, and many of the good decks for a couple months before that were running, like, 8 of them.
It was like a 2 or 3 month window. Like, in the grand scheme of MSEM, it was a bad time period. It was roughly when I, like, started phasing out of the format, but it also was a pretty short window.
Yeah, like,
yes, well, but
I feel like Odyssey was kicking around. Go ahead.
It was a very identifiable meta that was very easy to get into, and it was one that I had zero interest in being a part of. No offense, Splashcat.
Yeah, I enjoyed playing the deck, but it was also like, I could tell the meta was not good. I was...
I don't remember if I was the one who made the comparison or insert name, but there was a moment where someone looked at the decks and was like, this is basically Legacy Delver. And that's a good moment to realize, oh, that's not a good thing.
One of my rather dour jokes at the time was that sometimes tempo is just having your best cards be one mana.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I kind of played it like control more than like tempo. I'm not a great tempo gamer.
Well, you can go over the actual tempo deck because everything that you play costs less than the tempo deck.
Yeah, I was.
Where Rub was losing both on cards and on tempo to a control deck.
Yeah, which also had a beatdown plan because all of its cards were one mana.
Uh huh. So that's an example of, it was not a one-month affair. That went on for a few months. Idyllic Odyssey and others.
It just hit critical mass. It was like, Idyllic Odyssey was growing in popularity for a while. And then Epsilon and...
Embodied Soul
had seen. And then it was like, there were... I don't think there were any good decks playing all three one-mana enchantments, but... There were a lot of Embodied Soul plus Idyllic Odyssey decks, and I was on Embodied Soul plus Epsilon.
So that is, like, I think that's the ultimate example of, is not a 1 month affair. It's multiple months. It's a drawn out situation where people know that these are the best options and they don't play them anyway because they don't want to.
Yeah, I think
that's fair.
Wasn't that roughly the end of the era where the council tried to do like a year-ish where we were like, we're not going to make major changes every month. We're going to give the meta like a couple months to adapt at a time. And then if things still don't adapt, we'll start nerfing things. And there was this like kind of realization that we had of, oh, people aren't really adapting. You know, if people have to choose between adapt or die, people are more likely to choose die. And like ultimately, if that's how we should rebalance around that. That was later?
Yeah, I thought we didn't try that experiment until later, because I was not on council when I won that match, and I feel like I was. Proposing that.
What, that time?
I'm pretty sure that was not during the adapt or die era.
Because you weren't on council because Dodger hadn't stepped down yet?
I think Dodger was still on council.
Okay, that's the thing that I was forgetting in terms of sequence.
And I think Dodger stepped down like 2 months later, something like that. And then I got recruited.
Never mind my whole adapt or die rant. That's irrelevant.
Well, anyway, all this to say that people... I was one of the people who noticed Salome in the review. I know that there were other people who noticed Salome in their reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Council decided to take a chance on the card. It's not a matter of people didn't see it coming. People did see it coming. They saw that went unchanged and sort of accepted their fates. For much the same reason that in a more serious case, where it was not just a surprise within a month, but several months of the meta, they accepted their fates there as well.
Yeah.
I think there was a period of time in which people didn't quite internalize just how busted Idyllic Odyssey was. Like, we all knew it was good, but I feel like at the time I didn't, like, process just how much better it was than everything else you could be doing. I was like, and I just sort of gradually realized, like, around when that month where everybody was on a one-man team, it came up, I was like, yeah, no, Odyssey was like the, like, hang on, I've been, like, trying to fit Odyssey into, like, every deck. That was definitely a problem.
Yeah,
I feel like it's almost less like accepted their fate and more like kept paying attention to the parts of the game that they wanted to pay attention to and not to the parts of the game that were going to kill them for only playing those parts.
Also, there was pre-GP, there was no one playing Salome in leagues, right? Like, that's one of the reasons Kaylin was hyped up going into the GP was there were people just absolutely dominating leagues with Kaylin.
I think
it was just a couple of days, wasn't it? Kaylin also had some very vocal supporters.
Yes.
There's like a week in between the patch dropping and the GP starting, and I think there was probably like 100 matches within that time.
Yeah. Kaylin was the chosen deck of the people who talk a lot in hashtag deck building.
Yeah. Yeah, I get the sentiment. Hopefully, the nerfs to Salome, I think, will make her slightly less... There's no point to playing this game after you play Salome. It removes the instant speed board wipe aspect, which definitely did come up in the GP and is a very obnoxiously powerful aspect.
Oh, that's good.
And I think that the fact that she doesn't like basically guarantee that you see all of the cards you need to see... should reduce the power in some other meaningful ways. I think Salome is still going to be very good if the two lands she is untapping represents a very powerful and meaningful aspect of your game plan. And I think in some way, the fact that you can now slam her turn 5 in Heart Attack is probably something that people should be aware of and a reason to play Salome Heart Attack. But I think there's a good chance that I will not be on Salome Heart Attack this month. And I think that part of the truth is that 6-mana planeswalkers have to be really good to compete when we have really powerful 3 and 4 mana walkers. Like, Valerie is still lethal.
The list?
Sorry, what did you say?
Sorry, you cut out for me.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I said I think you 6-mana planeswalkers need to be powerful to justify playing them in a world with as strong 3 and 4-mana planeswalkers as we have. Like, Valerie is legal. Cecilius kills Salome on an uptick. You can add Johnny to untap two lands. Like, I don't think that there are things that Salome is doing that are uniquely powerful, but I think that the amount that she is doing is pretty proportional to her mana cost. And it's possible I'm going to be wrong and we have to nerf her again, but I don't think that's super likely.
Thinking about a Johnny, though, for that matter. But optimization on these kinds of decks is way more complicated than the more linear or proactive ones.
If you built on
one, will you be sharing the current version of Salome? Or Salome?
Mm-hmm.
You'll be sharing it?
Sorry, what do you say?
I asked if you would be sharing the list. If you're not on it.
Yeah, I could drop that in deck building at some point. I discussed it a little bit with Zangy, but mostly just in broad strokes. So I can throw together what my actual list would be if I was to register it.
All right. I think that more people should try playing it.
I think that's probably true.
Because right now the serious emphasis on this card's play is one.
I also think, broadly speaking, Heart Attack as a strategy has been really good for a while, and just no one has been playing it. And it seems that the current thing that people are trying to do with Heart of Zadina is from the Forest Heart, which is probably going to be better than Salome, but, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Can I figure out a way to run parallel games of Heart Attack and Matrix really well? If I figure that out, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, the serious efforts I'm putting towards deck building are optimization of existing decks, mostly based on simulations of their mana utilization.
Have you decided what your next optimization target is?
Yes, there's also the fact that when I was optimizing for burn, there is such a density of good burn cards that your card and mana utilization, if you're using the best in class for every mana bracket, it just translates directly to damage. You don't have to do any additional calculation there. In Villainy, it's just a check for our ability to play certain cards on certain turns, a mana utilization check, and we don't check card utilization because we're control deck. Don't waste your cards if you don't need to. But for Heart Attack, you need to, for one, Heart Attack having searchables really throws off the usual optimization approach. I would have to, I pretty much hard code some things, and I don't know if those hard coded state transitions necessarily translate to Matrix operations very well. Because Matrix, sorry, I'm really getting into the weeds of the computational part of this. Basically, the reason that I can run beam searches on some decks is because those decks have relatively narrow bands of the mana curve that they're playing in, and they play for a relatively small number of turns, and they usually are all modified every row of it in the same way. And this means that you can do vectorized operations on a matrix representing the state of each game in the simulation. A vectorized operation means basically you do it really fast. Like, you do it almost in parallel. In terms of computation time, burn takes like 20 to 30 minutes on my laptop. Villainy's simulations took, I think, like 2 hours. If I were to run up to a horizon of 7 or 8 turns on Heart Attack, with some non-vectorizable operations, that would take significantly longer. And I'm not sure if the objective of improving your mana utilization is even well-defined. It's less a matter of play this if you can in Heart Attack, and more a matter of if your opponent does this, then you do this.
Yeah.
One suggestion that I would make in terms of decks that I think fit this optimization pattern that I think are powerful and could warrant some optimization would be the show and tell decks. Because there's been a logic of turn one, cantrip, turn two, ramp spell, turn three, show and tell as the paradigm and ideal curve. And verifying that would be quite useful.
Verifying for balance purposes?
I mean, I'm not actually super worried about those decks balance-wise.
Because in terms of gameplay, and we can talk about the balance right now,
mm-hmm.
in cases where I have sideboarded properly, or even just had tech relevant to decks like your classic... Was that Blue Revelation?
Answer Midnight's Call?
Answer Midnight's Call. Answer Midnight's Call, it gets countered, you're dead.
Yeah.
Pod Watcher, you get Shikai's Redoubted on your target, you're dead. It's like, these are decks that play for four turns, and if you catch them in the act, they're dead. It's, yeah,
in the glory days of Leyline Alignment Field, Dodger just picked me apart and with Hand Attack and beat me with Unearth.
Yeah, like, I'm generally not interested in optimizing decks to then play them if they are decks that have no backup plan or that have a backup plan that is a completely different optimization question than their main game plan.
Since,
like the villainy deck can actually function without villainy. If you stall your opponent until you have Bell's Descent, it does not matter if you ever get villainy. Your opponent is just dead. Or Monument of Queens when you clean out their hand. It is, by all respects, a fair deck. And the flip side of being a fair deck is you can still win after one or two key interactions. With these combo decks, you can in fact set them up as a boundary value problem, and you can run them over some very, well, I wouldn't say easy, but like still reasonably easy matrix operations for the method that I'm using. It is absolutely a thing that I could do. And if it were like a serious concern, if someone were to ask me very seriously, Test, can you get me a rough estimation of what the best way to maximize this deck's chances of pulling off its game plan? I could maybe do that, but I sure as hell would not play it.
Understandable.
Fair enough.
Any
particular decks you are interested in optimizing and playing this way?
Aristocrats, the new build of Rug Tempo. Currently, the big question hanging over Rug Tempo right now is, do you still play Cane Dancer? The basic component of Rug Tempo is that you can get creature threats for your answers. This has been diminished repeatedly, and for good reason. Portal Fracture is an extremely fucked up card. The fact that you could, for example, get kind of a 4-for-1 in the best cases if you Cane Dancer a Portal Fracture on Wanderlust, it was unspeakably evil that you could do that at all.
And so now the question is, with Portal Fracture not also being a threat, is it still worth building your deck to take advantage of Cane Dancer?
So, in terms of Cane Dancer targets, we are down... We're down Portal Fracture. Bounty is no longer great. So in terms of Dancer targets, we're left with pretty much just Xilong Gust, which is an amazing card for Dancer, but we're not left with a whole lot else. Pip, is there anything else that I'm forgetting for Dancer now?
Not really.
So, for a new direction, I'm also wondering if Teemer Tempo has any advantages remaining over Jeskai Tempo. Styles, to an extent, is running an extremely good tempo build.
I would just go back to the Jeskai Mabel decks, because those were insane. And they have gotten some incidental nerfs. They can't, like, run people down, but they're still very good at out-tempoing people from a control deck perspective.
From a control deck perspective, yes. The thing with Mabel is... General school of thought for tempo decks, similar to Burn, you should not be wasting time on card draw. If you're consistently built enough, you should be able to win before card draw is ever an issue. Mabel will immediately start pulling you into a control mindset, where you are getting a persistent threat on board and also getting your card back. It's efficient, but it's not fast.
Right.
But Mabel was one that I had considered. In considering Mabel, I was also wondering if there were any sorcery speed pieces that we were really missing out on. But if you're going for fully committed flash tempo, that is the exact thing that you don't want to be doing. So the future of tempo is very much a big question. The reason that I'm so fixated on aristocrats now, to get back to the other topic, aristocrats did get some tools in MSL. Mad Queen Marguerite calls out Menace. I think that focusing on the Menace itself is a mistake. The card is already very good on its own, and it's 2 mana, which is generally good for a death payoff in Aristocrats. The main thing that is holding back Aristocrats right now is that the older builds of Aristocrats start to tend towards artifact strategies like Tide Hollow and Nihilistic Shock Trooper, mostly because the payoffs for specifically artifact deaths could just kill your opponent off of repeated triggers. And there was briefly a boogeyman of Vibrant Rapture, where if you played it in the correct sequence, you could just win that turn by looping petals.
The Vibrant Rapture was like 3 years ago. The last artifact aristocrats like GP win was substantially more recently than that.
Right.
Yeah, because Nihilistic Shock Trooper triggered on its own death and was generally very good.
And nowadays, Nihilistic Shock Trooper is
still actually fine. People are just babies.
Yeah, 4/60ths of my deck got nerfed. Time to play something else. Well, that's a bit mean, but
same as it ever was.
Yeah, I mean the flip side is 4/6 of my deck got nerfed. Okay, I'm gonna try the other deck I really want to play because both the big upsides and big downsides of MSDM are we have more potentially good decks than people to play them.
Yes,
this is true. The flip side also is that if you want a reasonable sample size for a particular deck, that means fewer decks being played total.
Yeah, that is the big downside. It's very hard to tell what the meta is because you don't have enough people, but also there are like constantly new decks for people to try, and it's fun.
Right,
and also gives people new play syndrome.
To stop being catty for a second, the mana curve on aristocrats is so ridiculously low that I think it'd be very easy to optimize. It's just a lot of the, let's call it research on the deck, people actively seeking out ratios and whatnot for using his pieces, seems to have stalled out in the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was briefly asking about that, but the general impression I got trying a handful of brews for aristocrats, I think I went through about 4 of them. My general impression was that the deck was not doing enough, and that the GP that we were heading into would be one of breakneck pace. Goblin Chariot, you need to be able to interact within the first 3 turns. Combo decks need to be able to interact within the first 3 turns. Legends, you need to be able to interact on turn 2. It was very much the wrong month to do it. Now, for going to the next month, I'm not sure if I should be focusing on making a new deck right now. I'm not sure if it's the time for brews. We basically got May and January with the sheer number of changes. Looking over the MSCM news, we've got about 2.5 pages of changes.
Along with that, our quest for the Rose Blade and Shidai reworks, but yeah.
Yeah, there were some designer changes, but for the main part, it's already a page on its own.
Yeah.
So, the question now is it worth trying something different while the dust is still settling? The risk I take by sticking with what is already known is I can fall prey to some new deck. You know, find the broken card, get yourself a free win. But, of course, the devil you know in this case is a deck that can reliably deal with large parts of the meta. Now, regarding the meta, what do you think it is going to look like next month?
I usually try not to fixate too heavily before GP in terms of meta guessing, because I think, as expected, people just kind of play whatever. I think we'll probably see a downtick of Kaylin. I think the current deck people are hyping up is from the Forest Heart related stuff. I think in general the control is getting a lot of hyped. So if people
could
can
you elaborate on the card?
Oh yeah. From the Forest Heart is the 5-mana Wilderness Reclamation / Wincon from Seasons of War. And I think between that and also just some general, you know, positing that people are doing, I would expect to see slightly more. I would expect to see more people who are not traditional control players on control this GP. I don't know if that means you should target to beat control, or if that's just, you know, play a good deck that doesn't lose to control. But if anyone, that's currently my only like meta read, is people are going to be playing these big, slow control decks.
I haven't been following the pulse of deck building super closely this past week, so I don't have a ton to say about the potential coming meta. I have been seeing people, including myself, playing black-red mid-range in League, which looks interesting, with Cecilius and Tunu, because land cycling and treasures make that consistent.
This is with the ACT basic land cycler?
Yeah. 4 copies of Prince, 2 copies of Shio Dragon Dancer.
Right. Prince was a rather exciting card when it was first previewed.
Yeah. And land cycling gives you graveyard fodder for Cecilius -2.
In the face of this mid-range, how do you think Unearth compares to it? Since
I'm not sure.
Some of the best mid-range cards, or at least what you would traditionally identify as mid-range for black, like Urchin King, are largely Unearthed pieces. Though in this case, you're disqualified from running that kind of strategy because you're running Planeswalkers at 4.
Yeah. I don't know. Unearthed might just be better, I'm not sure. It's...
And how's Tuno behaving in the two-color deck anyway?
Not as good as using Big Red. Still pretty good. The fact that the deck has a significantly higher chance than Big Red of spiking a turn 3 4-mana Planeswalker. Big Red has 4 Sizzle Mages. Or had 4 Sizzle Mages. Black Red has Vainbreaker's Cabalist, Pay Up, and Dragon Dancer.
Mm-hmm.
So Tuny's doing less, but not a lot less, and he's more likely to be doing it on turn 3.
Right. So both of these changes suggest generally larger curves. Could be interesting. I'll have to think about what
that
the correct way to
approach
that would be.
All right, I think we should wrap it up around here. Thank you both for joining me. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. And hopefully there'll be another GP recap episode at the start of next month. Until then, see y'all in the MSEM server.
Bye. See ya.